My guest today is Trashawn McCoy. When Trashawn was 17 years old, he was arrested, convicted, and sentenced to 55 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. In 2017, after being incarcerated for more than 20 years, McCoy's conviction was overturned. Joining me today is Trashawn McCoy. How are you, Trashawn?
Doing well today, sir.
Okay, so what I want you to do, because you're my expert and you're going to share your particular experience through your eyes with our audience who have no idea of what you've seen, what you've been through. So I want you to take your time, and if you don't mind, if you can go back to the night of the arrest, 1995, and recreate that particular scene and share with our audience, please.
I was arrested December 5th, 1995. Detectives from Chicago Police Force had come to my school. But prior to them coming, I was called down to the principal's office. I was in homeroom, senior year in high school, and I was called down to the principal's office. Now, at the time, you know, I was somewhat a nefarious kid, you know, getting in, you know, a little bit of trouble here and there. So I'm just assuming it was something that I may have, you know, done goofing off in the hallways or, you know, something of that nature. But as I, you know, had come to find out, it was way, way, you know, more serious than that. So once I got down to the principal's office, we had a youth officer by the name of Detective Spann. And Detective Spann, he, you know, pulled me to the side and asked me, did I know anything about a murder and armed robbery that occurred? Did I, you know, hear about anybody getting hurt, you know, the previous night? And I told him, like, no, you know. So, like, are you sure? I'm like, I'm positive. You know, I was, didn't have any, you know, involvement in any type of crime whatsoever, let alone, you know, somebody getting shot or, you know, getting hurt. So he said, okay. Well, he said some detectives from Chicago Police Force, you know, want to come and talk to you, you know, in regards to that. So about maybe a half hour or so later, detectives from the Area 1 Violent Crimes Division in Chicago had, you know, arrived. And once they got there, one of the detectives told me, you know, don't try to run. We know you did it. Somebody told us you did it. You killed those people on Western last night. And I'm looking at him like he has, you know, two heads growing out of his neck, because I didn't know anything about a murder and armed robbery or anyone getting shot. So they take me down to the police station. I'm scared to death, because I obviously never been in a situation such as that. And I get down to the police station, and the detective that told me, you know, we know you did it. We know you killed these people. You had something to do with this this double murder and armed robbery that happened on Western. I told him, you know, once again, that I had nothing to do with it, that I was over my friend's house. You know, you can call his mom, you can call him, and they can verify that I was there and he wasn't trying to hit at. So he would leave out, you know, another detective would come in and he would try to, you know, smooth it over. Well, we know, you know, that, you know, you had something to do with it, but, you know, just tell us what happened and you can go home. You know, he was trying a bit more softer approach, but I'm constantly telling him, like, no, I didn't do anything. I'm not guilty of anything. Mind you, I'm 17 years old. They haven't called, you know, my mother. I haven't had the chance to, you know, contact an attorney. So everything that's going on during this whole process is actually illegal because I'm a minor. So after, you know, the quote unquote, good cop would go out, the bad cop would come back in, you know, yelling and screaming, I know you did it. People, I know you did this. I know you did this. And I'm constantly telling him no. So this back and forth between the good cop and the bad cop This went on for about maybe another 7 to 8 hours. And then finally, I confessed, you know, because they told me if I just cooperated with them, I would go home. But the whole time, it was like they were just softening me up, just putting me through all this, you know, psychological torture to get me to a point where I would break. And eventually I did. So at that point, I signed a confession implicating three other people. They brought those three other people in who were minors as well, because we were 15, 16, 17, and 19. I was 17 years old, so the other three guys were also, you know, minors under 21. They brought them in, you know, worked them over for a few hours and got them to confess. So they made all four of us confess to playing the part in this double murder and armed robbery. After they booked us, you know, and charged us, they sent us to jail. And we sat in Cook County Jail for maybe three and a half years, but we were ultimately convicted. There was no other evidence at that time besides these statements, these false confessions that we made. No physical evidence, no witnesses, you know, pointing us out, saying that we did it, just solely false confessions. And this is what eventually led to us getting convicted. Two of us received natural life. I received 55 years, and another one of us received 20 years. Yeah, so we, at that point, we obviously went to the penitentiary. And about maybe 13 years later, it was a university by the name of Northwestern University, who we had all been writing. They were like wrongful conviction advocates. And they had an innocence program that, you know, incarcerated individuals could write to them and, you know, lay out the details of their cases. I'm now, but kind of giving you guys the condensed version, but you can, you know, write them and, you know, lay out your case for them, and they may or may not take your case. So up until about maybe 2007, 2008, I had been writing Northwestern, you know, in regards to my case. And I kept getting denied, So unbeknownst to me, all of the other gentlemen that were on this case were also writing. So they decided to take one of the other gentlemen on the case with me, you know, take his case. And at that point, once they got involved, it opened the case up. So once they were involved, they went back, you know, to the scene of the crime and the evidence locker, and went back to the cars that were stolen, because it was a double murder and armed robbery at a car lot, and two cars were stolen. So they had went back to the evidence locker, the Chicago Police evidence locker, and dusted the cars for fingerprints. So before we had went to trial, initially, we went to pretrial motions, the pretrial phase of, you know, of the case. We had been fingerprinted about three times in 1997, I believe. And each time, our fingerprints were taken to see if they matched up to these cars that were stolen. Every time, they came back inconclusive. But what eventually had happened back then, they had found that the prints weren't ours, but the state's attorney, the judge, they fraudulently concealed those fingerprints because they knew that that would free us. But the Chicago police didn't, you know, want to just, you know, share with the world that they messed up. So they hid the fingerprints and used the conviction to send us to prison. So fast forward to 2008, after, you know, about 12, 13 years, Northwestern got a hold to the case. And like I said, they dusted the cars for prints, and it came back that the prints weren't ours. So it was four of us, and these fingerprints that they found led to four more individuals, the individuals who actually did it. And eventually, not too soon after that, that's when we were released. But in total, we did 70 years of jail time. I did 22. My co-defendants did 20, 21, and the other co-defendant did 10. My math is a little off, but in aggregate, about maybe 70 years total. And
So Treshawn, so excuse me for interrupting. Do you recall the pressure that was exerted upon you to confess?
It was extreme pressure. Detective James Cassidy is probably one of the most horrible people that ever walked the face of this earth. This man, to just give you an idea of how horrible a person he was, he charged two boys, 7 to 8 years old, with the rape and murder of a 12-year-old girl. Now, when you are 7 and 8 years old, you don't even have a sexual desire, let alone even have the ability to produce semen at that age, like, because you're too young. This man charged two boys, 7 and 8 years old, with murder and armed robbery of a 12, I mean, with murder and rape of a 12-year-old girl. So this just goes to show you how horrible of an individual he is, just to kind of, you know, frame this. So he wouldn't stop at any length to get a confession and ultimately a conviction. He's just a horrible person.
So I want to now have you take us into the courtroom as you are standing before the jury and the judge, and tell me, what were your thoughts and how did you feel once you heard the jury make its verdict and the judge passing sentence? Can you take us back to how you, what you were feeling and how you felt?
When I received that 55 years, it's like my world just came to an end. Because when I received that time, I just turned 20 years old. And I would only have to do half of my time. Off the 55 years, I would have to do 27 and a half, but to be 20 years old and to potentially have to get out of prison at 47, like, it was just too much for me to wrap my mind around. I just was literally in a daze. Afterwards, I couldn't eat. I really couldn't sleep. I couldn't, like, think straight. It was just too much for me to handle. Too much for me to process. It was like one of the worst feelings you could ever have in life, to be handed down a sentence of 55 years for something that you didn't even know about and were tricked into confessing to. It was horrible.
And during all of this time, where were your lawyers? Or did you have a lawyer?
I didn't have a paid attorney. I had a court-appointed, they call them murder task force lawyers. And he actually a fairly decent job, but the fix was in to convict us. So no matter how hard he fought, it was a situation where we were all going to prison regardless.
So now I want you to, as only you can do, take us inside the cold prison cell that you occupied for so many years and describe to us what day to day, how did you deal with the situation day in and day out for all those years you were falsely imprisoned?
Well, starting off, to be totally honest, you're scared. You don't know what may or may not happen. But over time, I guess you begin to adapt to your day-to-day living. And you get to a point where you become desensitized to everything that's going on around you. And also, you are forced in a situation where you have to man up very fast. and you have to decide early on whether you want to be a victim or not. And I chose to not be a victim. So in that thought process, I had to transform myself into a convict. And that means not necessarily be a bad person, but toughen myself up mentally and physically in order to endure that type of environment and be able to last and you know, not be a victim. And after a while, you just become so callous and so desensitized to everything that's going on around you. It's like everything that's abnormal to most people becomes normal. It becomes normal to see, you know, other people engaging in homosexual acts. It becomes normal to see people get stabbed. It becomes normal to see people getting beat half to death. It's normal to constantly, you know, be in fights, be in riots. I've seen, you know, the guards kill two or three people in their cell. So it's a lot of things that you see on a day-to-day basis that you just become desensitized to, because you have to, otherwise you won't make it.
And as you came out of that particular culture back into normal culture, if I can put it that way, what was the adjustment period? How did you make the adjustment to coming out of the prison environment into societal norms?
It was very hard. It was like, I guess being from Mars and being a Martian, being dropped to planet Earth for the first time, because I had not been in free society for 22 years. I had left when I was 17 years old and had came back home at 39. So it was an extremely difficult transition for me, especially with technology. I'm doing a Zoom as we speak on an iPhone. And this, it might as well have been like, I don't know, for lack of better words, like an atomic bomb or just some type of sophisticated device that, like, I just had no knowledge of. I wouldn't even know how to turn it on, how to text, how to call, how to do anything on the phone, let alone a computer. After 8 years, like, I'm still, you know, learning certain things about, you know, technology and different devices, things that enable. My biggest hurdle coming home was just technology and being, you know, used to just the world, you know, as it currently stood, as opposed to how it was when I left. But that was like, yeah, the biggest transition for me was technology, hands down.
I want to read to our audience a very powerful statement that builds upon what you just said, and want to have you comment on it. You said, I don't know how it feels to be in your 20s, fall in love, dream of building a family, and create the stepping stones for your future. All of that was taken away from me as I sat in a cold jail cell, knowing the truth, but being unable to do anything about it. So now you're out, and what do you want to do about it in terms of setting the record straight?
Well, currently, I have a book that I'm writing. I also have a documentary that I'm shooting in regards to my life and the case. And I also have a nonprofit organization that's the Troshan and Dana McCoy Foundation. It's me and my wife. We're trying to bring awareness to wrongfully convicted people and their plight. Also, we are just for, you know, whether you're wrongfully convicted or not, we are trying to, you know, put together programs for job training and just overall just reentry back into society for those individuals who have, you know, spent, you know, decades in prison, because there was no programs available for people like me when I first came home. Even though I was in something I didn't do, I had been to prison nonetheless, and there were no programs in place that would, you know, help me reintegrate into society. I just pretty much had to wing it. So that is something that I'm doing, you know, through my foundation. And we are also helping, you know, the the children of individuals who are incarcerated as well. So that's the work that I'm, you know, currently doing, currently have on the table, and, you know, moving forward, you know, I plan, you know, many more things in that, in that space, in that realm.
Well, I have a colleague in Texas who is doing some innovative types of outreach with young men who are incarcerated, and perhaps you guys can talk and formulate and maybe collaborate on something and make something happen on a larger scale, because I think what she's proposing is groundbreaking, as well as what I heard you and your wife, what you and your wife are doing, equally as groundbreaking. So who knows? Let me know if you're interested in that.
Yes, I'm trying to reach out to partners, you know, all over the country, all over the world. So I will most definitely be involved, interested in, you know, partnering and linking up with other individuals who are, you know, trying to fight the same fight that I'm fighting.
Well, definitely. I will pass on the information to her, and perhaps you guys can connect if something comes out of this. As we get toward the end of this very fascinating first-person account of your experiences of being wrongly incarcerated, I'm just curious to know, what is your perception of police and police culture today? When you see the police, do you have a visceral reaction one way or the other toward police?
This experience has allowed me to open my eyes, because I'm really able to see that there is one shield, but when I say the shield, the police shield, but you have corrupt cops, but you also have cops that are out here trying to do a lot of good. And I didn't allow my emotions to just allow me to, you know, not be able to distinguish, you know, the two. I don't have this attitude that all cops are bad, because they are not. But the ones that are bad are really bad, especially the ones that trump up charges and put people in prison unjustly, wrongly. You know what I mean? So it's just that experience has allowed me to, you know, see the distinction, if you will. Yeah.
I'm just trying to imagine the strength, the stamina, the focus that it must have taken for you to day in and day out persevere in your situation. Just for a second, I'll point a personal privilege. My brother spent 5 years in prison, and one of the things that he had to do is reorientate his mindset to focus on the 5 years that he had to complete as his sentence. And he really had to be mentally strong. So talk to me about being mentally strong and staying focused on what you need to stay focused on.
For me, it wasn't something that I necessarily consciously did. And that adaptation to the environment, you just automatically you integrate into that space, that world. And I guess a byproduct of that for me was just making myself stronger, making myself tougher, both mentally and physically. Because you just look around you and you see that everyone is strong, mentally and physically. So it's like, you know, it's like a fish to water. That was my, I cannot speak for anyone else's experience, but that was mine. I just knew that I could not be weak. And it wasn't something, like I said, that I just consciously did, but I just, I don't know, I just built myself up. And, you know, just developed just a very callous and desensitized spirit in order to deal with everything that was going on around me.
My final question to you today, Chashan, is I'll say, who or who would you say inspired you the most, and who is one of these persons that is your inspiration? Is there an individual there who inspires you presently or in the past?
While I was incarcerated?
While you were incarcerated and after you were incarcerated, if you want to answer both of those.
Well, there's one answer for both of those, my mom.
Okay. Tell me about your mom.
Well, my mom just passed last year in February 4th, but you know, she was in a lot of pain, had a lot of health issues. So she's in a better place now, and I'm able to, you know, accept that. But while she was here, you know, in all those years that I was in prison, she was there every day of them, was there, you know, when I came home. And just, you know, her being strong and being able to stand by me all those years, that was one of the things that just gave me strength, gave me a source of strength. Yeah.
You can't go wrong with a mom, I'll tell you that.
No, you cannot.
My guest today has been Troshan McCoy. When he was 17 years old, he was arrested, convicted, and sentenced to 55 years in prison for a crime he did not do. In 2017, after being incarcerated for more than 20 years, Mr. McCoy's conviction was overturned. He's doing wonderful things, and he's going to and continues to be a positive asset as he continues to tell his story. Mr. McCoy, thank you. Thank you very much for being a guest today on Like It Is.
Thank you so much, sir.
I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.